kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 86, with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. Hello, Doug.
It's been a while, Di. How are you?
I am. I've got a sore throat, a bit of sinusitis, but I'm on holiday, so I don't really care.
Oh. So it's the, 7th of July, and you've been on holiday for 2 months?
Yes. So 50 years ago tomorrow, my mother and father decided to wed.
Right.
And so I'm up in Hull at their house, and that's where I'm recording this, just on my MacBook. And I've got to make a speech, so I can't. I don't want to ruin my voice for tomorrow.
All right. So you're basically saying I have to talk a lot.
Well, you do that without me saying, and you normally. How are you doing?
So, I'm good. There's lots to catch up on, so let's just do that really quickly. So, what's happened with you? Saving your voice, obviously. Well, and there were 3.5 weeks since we last talked?
Is it really that long?
I think so.
Wow. So I've just been doing... So the second half of the summer term is only 4 weeks long. So it becomes incredibly busy, especially for tech people. And so I've been organizing things and bringing things to a close and getting feedback reviews and projects I've been doing and stuff like that. I went down to see Microsoft at their offices in London for their showcase classroom stuff. Mm-hmm. And became a Microsoft Innovative Educator, which is...
How did you manage that, Di?
Well, it was really hard work. I sat in a room for possibly 5, maybe 6 hours, including lunch, and was awarded it at the end of the day. So, you know, I did try to, you know, vaguely analyze why they were giving me this thing, and it was because I had seen all the Microsoft tools and what they could possibly do.
Right, that makes you an innovative educator. Excellent. So,
I
good to know.
It.
Are you going to put that on your Twitter profile? Did they give you
I am.
Microsoft issue open badges? So, did they give you a badge?
They gave me a digital badge of some sort, I think, that I can plonk around somewhere. Anyway, there's a link in the show notes. If anyone's interested in going, and all you have to do is go and attend a day. So it's just worthless, possibly, or next to worthless. If
your words, not mine, and I okay.
So, but it was really interesting anyway. So you rock up and it was a small audience. There were about, I don't know, a dozen, 15 people there, teachers from different sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed us all of the tools. So Microsoft are releasing Teams, which they believe is a Slack thing, really. And it's going to be the comms to replace email, and that's going to put the glue that puts all the different things together. But I'm really concerned. So Microsoft are... An example of how ill-prepared Microsoft are for the education market, in my opinion, is that so their Surface device is digital inking, absolutely fantastic, because you can write on top of digital documents.
Mm.
But they have 3 versions of OneNote. So are you a OneNote user particularly?
No, I don't use any Microsoft tools.
Okay, so OneNote is a really good application for one reason and one reason alone. It has an infinite canvas.
Oh, yes, we've talked about this before and how useful that is with students, et cetera.
Yes, so it becomes a bit of a deal breaker, you know, it's a flagship killer, as it were, of other things in that regard. So if you're marking a PDF document and you're doing that within the margins and you're digital inking, that digital ink isn't going to go far or in the margins of a thing. If you've got an infinite canvas, then you can actually, you know, draw around a little bit and draw a line out to it and write quite a lot, or indeed expand the work in a non-conventional way, which is quite good. And so a lot of it, once you get into the idea, a lot of it depends on everybody having the same kind of digital inking device. Although, to be fair, OneNote is available on all major platforms, I think. I don't know if it's available on Linux, actually. Do Microsoft program stuff for Linux? I don't think they do they?
My best guess would be no.
Yeah, so you'd only have the web version on there, and that would be, that has limited functionality. So the problem with that is, let me think. Yes, so on a Microsoft product, if you're using a Surface, there are 3 different versions of OneNote. One is the web app. One is the actual Windows app that goes with the tablet, and the other is the actual full-blown software application.
Right.
And so so I challenged the trainer about this, lovely lady called Sam O'Leary, I think her name was, and she said that what you need to do is find your own workflow and just stick to that. So I...
So hang on, the three versions don't talk to each other?
No, they sync in the background, but the syncing is not as fast as some of the syncing that we're used to, possibly depending on the size of your files. And you have to sort of click it to sync it. Do you know what I mean? You have to force it to sync. So it's like refreshing your browser page kind of thing.
Oh, awkward.
A little bit awkward, yeah. I mean, not undoable, but a little bit awkward. And but the problem, so I said, I pushed back against her challenge of what I'd said about these three applications, because there are things like audio recording are not available in all of them, for example, which is an important thing for a teacher who's marking, giving feedback and things. And I just said, that's not the way. I said, that's fine for me. I can manage that. And anybody who's spending the time like today, they will get their head around that kind of thing. But if I'm just churning this out to a new teacher, it has to be, they're not going to understand that there are three different versions of the app. That, you know, you're just not going to be able to relay that kind of information and to choose their workflow. They want to be have a workflow suggested to them that works anyway. So it was just, and when you open it, it's going to open in different applications or whatever, you know. So like if you're on the web and you go to OneNote, it's going to open in the web app and blah, 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 blah. And then the functionality is not going to be there that they want. And they're going to be like, what's going on? So well, that's a real limitation in my mind.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah. So in the last couple of weeks, on this podcast, a recurring thing is my flip-flopping between kind of the ends of the spectrum in terms of wanting things to work first time and wanting a completely open source workflow. And the thing I've realized, especially this week, because I'm selling quite a few things on eBay because they've come to the end of their kind of life cycle. So for example, the family iPad, my iPad mini 3, PS3, etc. And all of these things, right, they've come to the end of their life cycle, not because I'm finished with them particularly, but because they're going to be unsupported by iOS 11 or whatever it is in a few months' time. And so it's a company telling me or my organization that the technology I've bought is now out of date. And they do that because, you know, things move on, but also because they want to have control of the upgrade cycle. Now, for me, I'm still using my OnePlus One. I've looked at the OnePlus 5, which has been launched since we last spoke, which looks amazing. But I look at it and I think, well, actually, so what I did yesterday, Di, I bought a new battery for my OnePlus One on eBay. It's a sealed battery, so I had to prise apart my phone to put the new battery in. But it wasn't hard. It took less than 10 minutes. And so I think the main reason now why I'm using open source software is so that nobody else can tell me when I'm finished using with a software product, with a bit of hardware or whatever. And I think that's especially important for schools, for public bodies, etc. I think it's really important that, like, it's not vendors who can tell you when you're finished with it or when you're going to switch to a different app, but when you decide to and your upgrade cycle.
I think that's right. I think there's... but it goes back to the old thing of open source schools, which both you and I were involved with back in the day. I mean, this is seven, 8 years ago. And is that it just makes absolute sense for open source software. Why that hasn't been developed by the government for all schools, who knows? And, you know, use central expertise in which to do this, and they just haven't done that. And the reason they don't do it is because they want to be part of the corporate mechanisms, I think, of Microsoft, Apple, whatever.
Well, interestingly, there's a new distribution of Ubuntu. Have we talked about this already? I can't remember because it's been so long.
The light one?
No, it's called NHS Ubuntu.
NHS?
Yeah.
No, I've not heard about
that. So it's a special distribution of Linux, of Ubuntu, for the NHS. So there's kind of a groundswell of, especially in the light of the ransomware attacks that hit the NHS, and given the austerity measures which are imposed on the NHS by the government.
So has this come about because of the ransomware attacks?
No, it was already kind of in the offing, but now Jeremy Hunt is totally behind this, apparently, because not only is it free, which is the best price he wants to pay, but it's obviously much more secure than, I think, some hospitals are using Windows XP and some are using Windows 7.
This is huge, Doug. Huge, huge, huge.
Yeah.
So to put Linux onto a platform that is accessible by, you know, many, many thousands of users, all of different levels of ability and responsibility, you know, from doctors to nurses to to administration staff, cleaners, whatever. Everyone's going to be using these computers, and it just makes enormous amount of sense because it will make kit last for longer, reference to what you just said about the iPads and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be superb. And then this will be a precursor for it going into schools, potentially.
Yeah. So, I mean, it looks all official and everything. I don't know if it's how widely it's adopted yet. It's probably just in pilot phase. But, yeah, it's certainly something which is worth running with. You mentioned the Open Source Schools Project. I was down in London last week for an SQA, so the Scottish Qualifications Authority, kind of expert assessment event. And so there were people there, people who I've, you know, cited in my essays before, the people like Guy Claxton and Patricia Broadfoot and people like that, kind of talking about what's wrong with assessment. And then some of us, so there was a guy called Joshua Perry, who is from, one of the, I think it's the ARC Schools spin-out company. I've forgotten what they're called. But they do data. It's a non-profit, and they do data kind of analytics and stuff for schools. Okay. And we were kind of talking about potential solutions around assessment. Obviously, I was talking about badges. I did a kind of elevator pitch, and we discussed it at length, and that was put forward as something to explore further. So I think there's, you know, further work to do there. But the people who were running that day with the SQA were Alpha Plus, and Alpha Plus were the ones who convened the Open Source Schools Group. And that was 10 years ago, Di, which makes me feel very old.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. It's quite interesting. I've just popped onto Edubuntu, which is the education version of Ubuntu that was done back in the day, partly of the Open Source Schools movement. And they're still working on the long-term support release 14.04.2 rather than 16.04. So that has not been updated, I'm assuming, because there isn't the appetite for it. And but they have different versions, one for preschool, one for primary, secondary, and tertiary, four different versions.
Well, it hasn't been updated since 2015, so that project isn't looking like very active.
But it would be, I imagine, on the back of the NHS one. So what you really need with this that you wouldn't get for the education market is you need a massive organization with its own developers to get behind it. So the NHS version is supported by, what's the company, Open Health Hub and Neova Health, which you imagine must have a sort of open source methodology to their working, to be working in Linux. And
And I think any, you know, if you look at, for example, Fedora is backed by Red Hat, who is a multi-billion dollar company. Ubuntu is backed by Canonical. Like, you need people who are, Mozilla, for example, with Firefox, you need people who are, you know, really funding it well and have a business model, etc. So I think you're right. And I think that the perfect place here is Multi-Academy Trust. So Multi-Academy Trust gets hold of a Linux distribution and goes, right, or let's do some stuff with this, and let's do it for ourselves, but also on behalf of the sector.
But you're going to have a Multi-Academy Trust where it makes a lot of sense to do it, and they have good intentions, which, you know, you're kind of worried about these Macs that they're not actually, they don't have good intentions necessarily. You know, they're business models, they're there to make business. And this
There's ways in which you can set that up. So I mentioned that guy, Joshua Perry. Let me see if I can find what his company's called, because you might be interested. But I think the thing to do here is, okay, if schools are going to be like businesses, we can fight against that, and I think we should fight against that. But the other thing we can do is we can think about how we can collaborate in that kind of environment. And the way you collaborate is by setting up an organization like a non-profit or a co-op or a charity or whatever it's going to be, who on the board or as the major benefactors are the Multi-Academy Trust. You'd have private schools in there as well. And what you're doing is creating a vehicle for investment, attention, and development.
We'll see. It's just potentially very, very exciting. Many things have been exciting and not come to anything, but
of course, if you go and take Edubuntu now, it's not like somebody can say, oh, you can't use that anymore because we've, you know, retired it. Like, it still works.
Yeah, no, so the issue is with that, is with the schools, and that I've always faced, is that technicians tend to have one skill set, and it tends to be around the major environment used in that school, which will be a Microsoft or Apple.
Yeah.
To get a Linux user, you have to be very advanced because you really need several expert Linux users, not necessarily to tweak to tweak the code, but just to get it working and operational over the network and driving all of the stuff that you wanted to, you know, you want working and people want to work seamlessly. And that's, I mean, that's the big deal about having NHS Ubuntu, is that, you know, you'd have a fleet of hardware and software that would be supported, and that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
That could be used, you know, that would concatenate along, not concatenate, it would cascade along.
Yes. Yeah.
Good.
Cool. Yep. So
I'd much rather see Mark Zuckerberg or whomever doing their anthropological projects doing something like that. even though you wouldn't trust him to do it cleanly, but, you know, just someone putting massive amounts of money into it rather than saying...
Well, one of the problems about having one organization putting lots of money into it is that obviously one organization then can pull lots of money out of it.
Yeah.
So it's much better to...
divert its, manipulate its actual usage, what's going on in the code, etc.
Yeah, which is why, although it's harder to do kind of small dollar crowdfunding, etc., it's much more sustainable to do it that way.
Mm. Yeah. Cool. Moving on.
Okay, so just three things I think I point to here. Obviously, it's been a while and I've written lots of stuff. Firstly, I recognize that version 2 of the Open Badges specification has come out and is currently being adopted by different badge platforms. And it's ratified and it becomes official once I think a certain, like, I think it's three major badge platforms have adopted it. So I know Badger have, Open Badge Factory are currently doing it, and I'm not sure whether the ones at the moment. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so people aren't really sure about what's possible with the new version of the specification, and without going into too much detail here, I've tried to provide some clarity on that, and indeed, Kerry Lemoy has written some other stuff on that as well, around endorsement, etc. So read that. The second thing I've done is redesigned dougbelshaw.com, so that's like my landing page, because originally, Di, that was a Mozilla Thimble page, which I'd created as a template so other people could have a portfolio page. But Thimble has changed, it's no longer part of WebMaker because WebMaker is defunct and the code wasn't great. So what I did was I paid like $15 for a really nice, responsive, clean theme, and just redeveloped on the train on the way back from Dundee a couple of weeks ago, dougbelshaw.com. So have a look at that.
Super.
And then finally, in terms of like the productivity stuff, you know, I'm still working on that audiobook, the productivity audiobook. But a guy called Robin Dewar got in touch, and he subscribes to Thought Shrapnel. I think he occasionally listens to this podcast. So hello, Robin, if you're listening. And he said that he was working with his team to try and figure out how they could use email more effectively. And did I have any links for advice? And I thought, well, there's lots of different links I'd send, but instead of sending lots of different links, I just had some spare capacity and I decided to take 10 tips that I thought were useful by way of email productivity. So I put that together.
I'm just reading through your list. Should we do your list?
Yeah, let's do the list. Okay.
Number one, turn off notifications.
Should we talk about them or should we just go through them?
I think they'll be self-explanatory.
Okay, number two, prepare, but don't send emails on Sunday evening.
Number three, be concise.
Number four, tell your boss what you're going to do and then what you've done.
Number five, communicate facts by email and emotion face-to-face. So communicate facts by email, emotion face-to-face.
Yeah. Number six, have multiple channels to message people.
Number seven, be positive.
Number eight, treat emails as if they're postcards.
Number nine, avoid techno-productivism. What on earth's that? Avoid techno-productivism. You mean using it for the sake of using it?
Yeah, and just trying to be more productive. You know how there's a difference between like doing the wrong thing faster versus figuring out what the right thing to do is?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like where your inbox is dictates your work of the day, and you do your email and you think, yeah, I've got my work done, and then you realize you haven't actually done any of your work. All you've done is handled your email.
Yeah, and this is from Cal Newport, who's it's from a blog post about his book called Deep Work, and he says, we've ended up with a knowledge work culture in which people spend the vast majority of their time trying to keep up with the very inboxes, devices, and channels that were conceived for the exact opposite purpose, to liberate more time for more valuable efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And number 10 is sign off with thanks in advance. So this is from the Boomerang blog. So Boomerang, you might use this, Di. I know. Do you use Boomerang?
No.
Boomerang is a plugin for Gmail. I think you can get it for Outlook as well, where it allows you to compose an email now and then send it in future. And it also allows you, a bit like the follow up then app. It allows you to like bring it back into your inbox if someone hasn't replied, etc. Anyway, they did some they did a study in terms of how people replied, etc. People opted into the study. And they found that any time people said thanks in advance in signing off their email, people were much more likely to reply.
Really?
Yeah.
Actually, I've often wondered that. So I've never used thanks in advance because it's because I didn't believe that that would be the case. It'd be better to do a more so generic endings don't necessarily work.
Yeah, like the worst one I think was something like best wishes or best. Yeah, the one I really liked as well was about communicating facts by email but emotion face to face.
Yes, I think that's a really, really important one. I just had to give some advice to a senior person on our staff about getting themselves into trouble by sending what they believe to be a standard and fine, cheeky, you know, tongue-in-cheek communication to someone they knew, and that someone they knew then forward that communication to get them into trouble, kind of thing.
Oh dear.
So I had to give some advice on that, and exactly that.
It goes with the whole kind of treating emails as postcards thing. So
yeah, no, absolutely. But it's the whole idea. Even if it's something good and positive that you want to say about a pupil or about that, if you've got emotion to communicate, go and do it face to face, because if it's positive, it's going to bring so much more to the recipient.
Yeah.
Face to face, and if it's negative, it's the same sort of thing. You're going to get a better effect from doing it face to face.
Definitely. So they were the 10 things. So and then there's my audiobook where I go into other stuff as well, and I'm hoping to finish that off over the summer. So there we are.
Cool.
There has been since we talked, there have been so many fantastic articles. It seems like there have been more fantastic articles than usual. So sometimes we scrabble around finding stuff which we would fit for this podcast. But, you know, seriously, last 3 weeks, we could talk for hours.
Mm. Well, let's get on with it then. So we'll go through the list as they are.
Yeah, okay, right. So the first one is young men are playing video games instead of getting jobs, and that's okay for now.
I think I read this, but I can't remember. What was the gist of it?
So it's basically saying that there seem to be a lot less men in their 20s in the US in the workforce, because the jobs just aren't there for whatever reason. Now, interestingly, this person, Peter Sudeman, usually when someone writes an article like this, they're writing it as an outsider, so they're not a gamer themselves. But this guy is a gamer. So if you could go right to the bottom of this article, he talks about whether spending a lot of time, like living with your parents in your 20s, playing video games instead of being in the job market because you can't find a job, is a positive or a negative thing. And usually the gist of this kind of article would be, oh, well, you know, they're trading long-term success for like short-term enjoyment. But he's saying, actually, no, because video games do teach you some useful things and collaboration and happiness. And instead of being despondent and, you know, picking up a gun and going to shoot people or whatever, they're doing this stuff online. It talks about VR and stuff. So it's a really interesting, quite nuanced article that I don't think we'd potentially do huge amounts of justice in the short amount of time we've got to discuss it. But just to say that I have been messing about with VR with my kids over the last week or so. And so Accenture came into my son's school, and also the British Army and some other people. And he had a great day firing real guns and then going into VR and doing all stuff. So he came back home and got this is the Google Cardboard viewer. Yeah. And was messing about with that. And then I got a proper one, which was only a tenner off Amazon. It's great. And we've been doing all kinds of stuff, going underwater, using the Google Expeditions app. Have you used that, Ty?
I've not, no.
Oh, seriously, the Google Expeditions app is fantastic. Now, I know what Audrey Waters and other people have said about, you know, VR being problematic in terms of, on a macro scale, what we're saying is like, oh, you don't need to actually go and visit these things because you're poor children. Instead of, you know, actually going to visit these things, you can see a VR version. But, you know, I used to teach history, and some of the stuff you wouldn't get access to. And secondly, it would just be, it wouldn't be cost effective. There's no way you could take kids from, you know, oh, today we're going to go in ancient Egyptian temples, and then tomorrow we're going to go to look at Mayan civilizations. And what it does on the Expeditions app, Di, it's really good. So you're a teacher, you don't need internet access, just Wi-Fi, once it's downloaded. And then on the guide version, You can control what's happening in all the different headsets. So for mine, it's just obviously one. You can pause it at any time, but you can also see what people are looking at because it has little faces superimposed on top of the VR landscape. So you can see what they're looking at while you're scrolling around looking. And it gives you like a background information about the experience and some questions you could ask, and you can swipe through and there's like five different things for each packaged experience. So it'd be an underwater looking at how coral die because of bleaching, because of climate change. We've been looking at Mayan and Aztec temples, all kinds of stuff, and they are blown away by it.
It's interesting. So what extent is that putting a layer on top of it that makes it like are they learning, do you think, when they're doing it, or is it just like spellbinding, but it's not actually necessarily giving them any information or any knowledge or other than seeing it? I don't know.
Well, here's how I would use it. If I was going back to teaching, right, I would use this as the hook to get them into the thing that we're doing. Yeah. So I'd use it as a, because things can be really interesting. Like you can get immersed in learning about the French Revolution just from reading lots of texts from the time. But that's a really hard sell to year eight on a Friday afternoon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would stick them, I wouldn't use it every lesson. I'd be like, okay, we're going to be doing Mayan civilizations. All right. And so there'll be a VR thing. I'd be showing them some, like a reenactment on a big screen. I'd be doing all this kind of stuff. And just to get them excited about it, and then we'd be going into some other stuff. I'd use it just to liven things up a bit in the same way that I used to use Battlefield Britain to bring things to life. Yeah.
Sure.
So I was amazed by it. And also it allows them to just look at things closely. Because I remember, and we've discussed this before, Laura Hilliger, hi Laura, if you're listening, she's just come back from Japan. She talks about how you need to give people stuff to do with their hands. Now, when you're in VR, you can't see your own hands. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so engaging. Because you can hold one of those little things to press next or whatever it is. But you're just looking around and you're seeing all this amazing stuff, and it's really quite engaging. I have to say I was a bit of a skeptic, but having gone in there and done some stuff, I am pretty blown away. The last thing I'll say on it is that there's now the Google Cardboard camera app, so you can create your own versions of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So my son, we went to Holy Island, Lindisfarne, last weekend, and Ben was, they just discovered a Norman church on Holy Island that they didn't know was there before. And to protect it from the weather, they're going to cover it over again. And it was the last day when it was uncovered. And so he created this 360 view, including the Norman church.
All so, right. Okay. Yes. So other people will be able to access it.
Yeah. Really cool.
Very cool. Excellent. That sounds like fun. So class sets of VR headsets at BET don't look so stupid anymore.
No, but the situation in which they were using it is still ridiculous. I would not. Yeah, there's certain situations in which I would use them, but the way that it was set up with BET was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Anyway, yeah. Let's leave it there.
Cool.
Shall we go on to Why EdTech Sucks by Graham Brown Martin?
Yeah. This was a sort of interesting article. It didn't really say. Yeah, it kind of says it doesn't for some. For true innovators, it will be fine. But mostly there's just a lot of companies trying to make money out of EdTech, and they're just not very good.
You mean for EdTech Week, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, EdTech Week is...
So I didn't know this was going on, by the way. I'm the head of digital strategy in a school. It's probably my bad, and it was not at the right time for me, but...
Di, I didn't know it was happening either, right? This is not... So the point that Graham's making here is that EdTech doesn't exist, really. That's what he's saying. He says... EdTech today doesn't really exist. At best, it's just education using modern appliances. But at worst, its focus is the reductive standardization of teaching and learning to teacher-proof content distribution and testing. In this latter form, it's the exact opposite of education.
I think so. I think I work in ed tech. So to say it doesn't exist is a bit strange. And I get what he's saying here, but really he's talking about, so I would say ed tech at its best is using modern appliances in education. And that's what's going on, isn't it? Like you were just talking about VR headsets. I mean,
but
introduction into the classroom, it's not a straightforward thing.
But there's people using the same word or shortened phrase for different purposes. So when we talk about EdTech, we're talking really about it's situated in a history. We're talking about, like, we're based on if it's a Zeugma, as it's known, like educational technology, our focus is on the education part of that and the technology supports it. Whereas for the industry, education is just another market to sell technology into.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right.
So what they're trying to do is, like, the problem here is teachers, and oh my goodness, like, can they just get with the program? And, you know, Graham's done a lot of great work in calling out some stuff that's happening in Liberia with is it Bridge Academy program, where they're scripting teachers. So teachers are on a script. They've got such a problem with teacher recruitment, etc., that they're using untrained teachers and putting them on a script, and they're just reading out the script basically, and they've got some technology and they're accessing the technology, and it's all just scripted to the minute. So, and he's saying how that is, if it's on a spectrum, and there's got the kind of stuff that I hope that I used to do and the stuff that you want to do on one end of the spectrum, this is way on the other end of the spectrum, and that the logic of the technology industry, the ed tech industry, is to move towards, like, disintermediating teachers so they can just go straight to the students and everything's just mediated by technology.
I'm just a little bit reminded here of numeracy and literacy hours in primary schools. Weren't they scripted and timed to the minute? Like, you now do this for 2 minutes, and every teacher had to do the same thing.
Yes, I think they were. Yeah, I didn't.
As a means of upping numeracy and literacy levels in our country generally.
And do we still have them? No, we don't.
No, we don't. Absolutely, because they're soul destroying. But what's interesting about that is if you're scripting teachers, and the script is better than what the teacher did in the first place. So you basically don't have to have teachers. You just have to have a person saying the things and discipline. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's what they're trying to push for, I would imagine, is that they do no longer need their teachers to be skilled in any way, shape or form. They just need a human being at the front of the classroom to say the things that are on the sheet at the right times and stick to it. And make sure that the children are all behaving and doing what is directed. And then they have what they consider to be an education, which obviously it isn't.
There's so many issues here, Di, that I don't even know where to start. And I was talking about this with my wife yesterday. We were walking down to my son's sports day, which was glorious. You know, he won the 200 meters, became second in the relay. And it was like, for all I like people being included and all that kind of stuff, it was a really very competitive event with people breaking house records from 1986 and stuff. And it was wonderful. At the same time, there were loads of kids just sitting along the side, very well behaved, not participating, yeah, because they hadn't been selected or they hadn't put themselves forward or whatever. And we were talking about how, you know, we're sending our kids to we're not going to send them to private school. We made that choice. We're sending them to the best state schools in Northumberland, and we live in the area, and our house is worth more money because of it, and da 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 da. But even so, I'm still not happy with the. And they're not. I can't point to any one thing that the school's doing wrong. It's just the whole system is set up so that you squeeze the children towards academic success. And that's the thing that matters through high-stakes exams. And my kids, like your kids, Di, will be fine and do well and successful or whatever that means. But this is the thing which then feeds into technology, and everything is measured by high-stakes exams and funneling knowledge into kids' heads. Whereas some of the stuff I've just been talking there with VR is about delight and wonder and exploration and stuff. And there's so much to unpack in there that I don't even know where to start.
Well, it's I think it's a really difficult thing, isn't it? Because education is a really, I mean, I often wonder, I met, so this week I've been hanging out with Amy Burble a lot this week. She's over from America. We've been down for a trip to Cornwall, which I'll talk about in a minute, about a museum we visited, which is amazing.
Cool.
But she had a book launch on Wednesday. And a few friends of Tide rocked up there.
We need a link to her book. Just remind us what her book is called.
It's called Intention, Critical Creativity in the Classroom, and is on Amazon. Thank you for doing that. And and so Brian Mathers rocked up, Elan rocked up, Elan Ezekiel, Adam Proctor, who I've never met in person before, came along as well. Fantastic to see the three of them, and we had a really good time. Other teacher friends of mine who wouldn't listen to Tide, who came along, and some other
people. Why would they not listen to Tide? That's ridiculous.
I have no idea. I think they have enough of me in real life. And so it was a great evening, and it was at a funny time. It was the EdTech team are the publisher of the book, and they were putting on the event, and they booked this place out at 3:30 in the afternoon. So obviously everybody who's working in a working week couldn't attend. A friend of mine made a very big effort to come straight after work, and he didn't get there till 5:30 when it had finished. But we stayed around and had drinks well into the evening and enjoyed London life and all it had to offer. Mm-hmm. So it was fantastic. So in that, why am I telling you about this? I had conversations about, I was having to reflect upon what is it, why that an independent school provides a liberal education better than any other, an arts education better than any other organization, other school, because the state sector schools are getting that side of things squashed and squashed out of them. And I think that's connected to what you just said in some ways. So we have, obviously, we're a well-resourced school, but we're also very well-resourced in terms of time because we're a boarding school. Mm-hmm. So we can do all sorts of interesting things, theatre productions and debating and lots of interesting talks. Students can run their own societies, things like that, that enhance and what you get whilst you're at a school. As well as we have selected pupils, which means in my lessons I can rely on them to go away and learn something that I tell them to learn that's quite dull and straightforward and exam factory style, specification driven, and I can enhance the lessons with what I consider to be tangential, relevant, but not in the specification material connected to technology. So that was just an interesting conversation.
Cool. Interesting. So Amy's book's available now with Dan Ryder. I'll put the link in the show notes. Came out on the 8th of June, so a month ago. And
so it's officially launched by the EdTech team on the 17th of July, I think. But
oh, is it? Right, okay.
It's obviously just because they're giving fair service to their different titles that they're publishing. But it's
got recommendations from people who like Austin Kleon, Clive Thompson, really well-known people, Howard Rheingold.
He does the foreword, Howard Rheingold, which is very, very complimentary. And Dan and Amy get a lot of the endorsements on it. So I helped Amy set up for the book launch and was typing out all the endorsements to stick around the room. And the things people have said about it on Amazon as well, just go and have a look. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, I am pressing purchase on this right now.
Right, wowee. There we go.
Good stuff. For some reason, it's come on the Amazon.com thing. There we are. One of the problems I've got this week is that I am in between password managers. So,
Use
a password manager, do I?
I use LastPass, yes.
So I have decided not to use LastPass anymore, even though I've been using it for the last 6 years. So in the spirit of, making my life harder, I've decided that LastPass, who are owned by LogMeIn, are not a very nice company particularly. Some of the features they have make me not really trust them in the sense of I think that we're only one hack away or one major hack or one government request away from someone having all of my passwords. So storing them in the cloud doesn't seem like the most awesome idea in retrospect. And also, I feel like I want I want zero knowledge. So anyway, long story short, there's a service called LessPass. Now LessPass, there's a Chrome extension. I think the only thing they don't have is an iPhone app. But what it does is the easiest way to do this, I have written a blog post about this, so let me stick this in. The easiest way is to look at, there's an animated GIF which shows you how it works. So you type in, and let me just put this link in here for you, Di. You type in the name of the service, which could be the URL of the thing that you're using. And you type in your username as well. And once you've done that, you type in your secret. So your secret is like your passphrase or whatever it is you use, like your master password on LastPass. Mm-hmm. And you could use different ones for every different service. But the way they're suggested to be used is that you type in the name of the service, so Slack, for example. You type in your username, which is often your email address, and then you type in your secret. So it might be a phrase like a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. That isn't mine, but you know, something like that. And then what it does is it uses an algorithm, which is hashed in all different kinds of way. And once you type that in, it then generates a passcode, which is always going to be the same. On whatever device you kind of generate it on, once you put in that three bits of information, and then you use that. So it's never stored anywhere. It's just generated every time you need it.
All right, okay. That's an interesting idea. Mm. I once saw this about, this similar concept is happening now with credit cards. So rather than you actually owning a credit card, you would own a service that allows you to create credit cards, and every instance of the card is created every time you use it. Because it would just be a digital affair. So
it's a unique number every time you have a transaction. Exactly.
So your credit card details will be of no use to anyone if they secure them, because you'll never ever use them again. Which is what computers afford us to do. Interesting concept, and a similar concept to this.
One last thing, let me just say on the LessPass thing, and it seems like such a small thing, but it makes my life better in a small way. You know, if you can touch type or you type in a reasonably long password on a regular basis, mm-hmm. and when you type it, you only see like asterisks or little dots instead of what you're actually typing in. There's a large chance that you're going to get that wrong occasionally, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so what I find myself doing on LastPass is pressing the little I button to the right-hand side of that field where I'm entering the passphrase to make sure that I'm entering it properly. But of course, that defeats the point, especially if people are around you, because they can potentially see what you're typing in.
Mm-hmm.
So what LessPass does, which is genius, is when you type in your passphrase, it's still obfuscated, like it's still coming up with little stars or dots. But as you're typing, there's three little emojis that are changing on the right-hand side. Mm-hmm. And if you type in your passphrase exactly as you've typed in before, those three emojis will be exactly the same every time. So although you're not looking at the master password or the passphrase itself, if those emojis are the same every time, then you know you've typed in your password correctly.
That's clever.
It is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I like that a lot.
It is a big thing, I have to say, with these devices. So if you're using a tablet device and you're projecting it onto a screen and you put your password in, because even if it doesn't show the thing, because your screen's on keyboard, anybody looking at the screen can see that what your password is.
Mm.
It's a real, you know, when you can imagine when you're teaching, loads of teachers are going to forget about that and have their tablet casting onto a screen and tap it in, and the children just watching the buttons press on the keyboard, seeing what their password is and not saying anything and then being able to use it later. I'm sure that's not happening, but
I'm sure it is happening a lot. My son managed to get around the Safe Family app that I've been using.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, I don't know how exactly he did it. My suspicion is that we set up a new tablet and I don't think I locked it down properly. Anyway, I'm on the one hand, I'm extremely proud that as a 10-year-old, he's managed to get around this thing that I've put on there. And he was getting up at 5:30 and going on there, whatever. But on the other hand, I realized I read some stuff by Mimi Ito, and she was talking about the problems of limiting people's children's screen time.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying, which is certainly something I've seen, is that if you limit their screen time to a certain amount of, you know, arbitrary time, what they do is they just do the stuff which is gaming and enjoying themselves and stuff and chilling out, like we would if we were given a certain amount of time to do things. Mm-hmm. Which means that they never get to the creativity, the making, the experimenting, the tinkering, because they just want to play.
Yeah.
So I've then been caught between two stools. On the one hand, I kind of have to discipline my child for going outside of the restrictions that I put on. But on the other hand, I realize that the restrictions we put on are unfair and counterproductive. So it's coming up to the summer holidays, and we're going to relax a lot the amount of time that they're allowed to spend on screens, etc., and just to see if that makes any difference in terms of what they do, if they just play games all the time, or if they actually, you know, start building things, making stuff, whatever.
We've had this. So I've had a difficult thing at school this last month as well. So you remember the screen time committee thing that I've talked about?
Oh yeah, how did that go?
Well, they put their proposals forward, and unfortunately, the gentleman who ran the you chaired the meeting didn't send the proposals to me. So I was aware that they were going to be discussed, and so I emailed, you know. So anyway, the long and short of it is that our junior pupils, which is up to year 11, they are not going to be allowed to have their phones in class anymore. So after 2 years of having that, we've done the thing. So I've been dealing with teachers who are really, really quite upset, particularly because pupils are going to lose their cameras. So you can imagine which subjects that are in. So art and DT and that sort of thing. Really, really disappointed. And so I've had senior hards, maths were really disappointed as well. They've been having children accessing exam papers on their phones as a standard practice.
Yeah.
Things like that. And it saves so much printing and all of that, and it's been just very sensible. So this thing has gone away, and it's not really good. It's been driven by pastoral reasons rather than academic reasons.
Right.
I'm not particularly pleased by it, to be honest, but it's part of the reason that I'm not pleased about it is that people don't learn how to use something without some freedom to use it. So,
yeah, exactly. So the thing which we've done literally in the last 24 hours is, I think I've mentioned before that my family, since about 2010, have used a social network called Path.
Mm-hmm.
So I put on, as for discussion and debate on Path, just as a status update, to everyone involved. So that's my sister, my in-laws. My sister's sister and her brother-in-law, my parents and my wife's parents. So quite a tight-knit group. And there's certain norms of kind of ways of interacting have evolved over time. And so Ben's cousin is a year older, so 11. And Ben is 10. So I thought it was about time for them to learn how to do kind of social networking in this kind of environment. So as of last night, they are now on Path. And we kind of, my wife and her sister, both teachers, their concern was about appropriate use, yeah, and about sharing photos which are shared on there, which, you know, don't go any further. They're not like reshared on Facebook or anything.
Yeah.
So the two bits of guidance we settled on were, number one, don't take a photograph from Path and then share it anywhere else, nor should you show a photograph on your phone which has someone else in from your family that, you know, they don't know that you're showing them that photo. Yeah, showing someone else that photo. And secondly, like, don't spam people's timelines. Don't put loads of updates one after another, because that really annoys people. And they were the only two bits of guidance we put on there, and I think the rest of it is going to emerge over time.
Yeah, no, I think different things about that. I think it's really important to bring variety to how you use technology with your children, which you're doing. I think that's a really good thing. So rather than it all be managed, you have to sort of slowly break into the idea of doing different things. The other thing I'd say, so in my experience, and this is dealing with older children than yours, is that they just care less. This whole thing about being very protective about photos, about asking permission to take photos when they're among their friendship groups, and things like that, they just don't do that sort of thing. And it does cause problems, but they just, you know, they just care less, basically, about it than we do. And I think that's it's a really sort of interesting thing. And I know that, I mean, now, whenever I see someone with a phone out in the pub or something like that, who, you know, one of my friends, I'm kind of like a little bit suspicious about what they're doing. Pupils the same. So I'm like, are you taking pictures, you know, when your phone's at the wrong angle, kind of thing. And I saw a really interesting tool the other day. It's a camera lens that you clip onto your phone and it changes the angle of the camera. So if you're holding your phone horizontally in the horizontal plane, the camera will be pointing straight forwards at the top of your phone.
Oh, wow.
And it's not done as a spy thing, but it would actually surmount to that, because somebody would be looking straight down and they can see in front of them.
It would be good for use on the tube.
Well, that kind of thing, yeah, on the tube, or you can imagine the sort of number of uses it would be put to people with devious, perverted sort of intentions of sorts.
Well, we're always catching up with these kind of things. Like, I think Snapchat maps have come out since last time we talked.
Yeah, that's right. This Snap maps are out, which is a really interesting thing about, obviously, people using Snapchat within the geographical location, same geographical location. Got to be careful of that stuff. Although Snapchat, to be fair to them, when I looked it out to put a notice out before the end of school about it to the pupils, like, be careful over the summer with your Snap maps, it's not forced on for everybody. You have to go and activate it, and they're trying to look after it, but I'm sure they'll do that in the first instance, and in 6 months time it will just be in there, you're all on, to make a success of the service, maybe, I don't know.
Yep. Oh, there's some kind of dogfight going outside my office, sorry if you can hear that. Right, so Ian O'Byrne, hi Ian, who's a regular listener to this podcast, I think, he put in Slack, actually, the Slack that we're on, the We Are Open Slack channel, that he was going to be interviewed by a journalist about how, as parents, we can make sure that our children don't fall behind during the summer break, summer vacation. And so he asked for advice, and he had some great advice himself, and the kind of things that he suggested are read, write, play, and hack. And there's some great advice in here. The post called What to Do With Your Kids During the Summer, Read, Write, Play, and Hack. And the reason why I thought it was good is because he gives kind of some of the theory, I guess, behind it, like why it's a good idea to do writing or playing or hacking, and then tells the reader how to make it happen. So it gives some guidance. Talks about things like links to like code.org, like games from Google's Instructables, etc., and the kind of things that people can do. So I thought it was a useful thing to point people towards, given that the summer holidays, I guess, have already started for you and for people in the US, but for those in state schools in the UK, we've still got another couple of weeks.
I'm just looking through. It does look good. It looks fine. It looks nice. I like the idea that he's sort of riffing on the idea of reading, meaning audiobooks, podcasts, whatever.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? Just consumption of words, basically. And writing, not meaning writing words, but using Minecraft, stop motion animation movies, things like that.
Yeah, it's multimodal, isn't it?
Yeah, I would argue that's always the case. I think the most important thing with whatever you do with your children is that you're talking to them about it. That's the thing. And like acknowledging and recognizing what it is that they're doing. Whether they're even just watching telly, I think that's important.
Yeah. My kids have learned so much from Blue Peter over the last few weeks.
Have they?
Yeah.
Is it still on Blue Peter?
Yeah, my daughter's got two Blue Peter badges.
You're joking too?
Well, they give them away slightly more easily these days, and there's different colours.
Okay. There's different colours?
There are, yes. So her picture was featured on Blue Peter.
That's superb.
Yes.
I didn't know your daughter was famous, though. okay.
Well, it's different these days. So where are we at? So there's loads more stuff we could go through here. Is there anything that kind of jumps out at you?
Let's have a look. I like this idea of turning your phone to grayscale.
Okay.
Let's have a look at that. everyone always asks me, how can you bear your phone being so yellow? Because I have blue light filters on them.
Oh, do you have it on all the time?
I do, actually. So what I do on my OnePlus is I have the nighttime filter on all the time. I just don't see any point in turning it on, off. Just get used to it. It's not a problem. And so I don't use blue light filter anymore because it had to overwrite. There was a new thing in more recent versions of Android, or in my version anyway, where it had to overwrite on top of other apps. And if you allowed that, then it would just get in the way and be annoying at different times. LastPass was the same on this, actually, using an authenticator and things like that so that it could log you in. Anyway, this article is about turning your phone to complete grayscale because all those colors are so damn exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a... You can do it on the iPhone, I think do it on Android as well. So on accessibility mode, you can just turn it on to grayscale. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing, you know, it says for people with full color vision, it makes your phone drab. Perfect. But does it work to hinder tech companies' attempts to capture your attention? I spent a week with my phone in grayscale mode to give it a go. I can report that the answer is sort of.
As always. Mm-hmm. So I think it's... we've discussed the sort of the strong magnetism that a phone has for anyone. They're like beautiful, beautiful devices. They're really shiny. They play video. They play games. They're immediate responsive to the touch of your fingers. They do stuff with your voice. They interact with different sensors in different ways. And they're really quite something to, you know, of all the objects in the world, the only thing that really beats a phone is good hard nature, you know, beautiful greens and blues and whatever of nature doing its thing. And but phones are pretty important.
Yeah, and they go through this. They say that, okay, so we assume that the reason why we're so addicted to our phones is because they look so lovely and colorful and things. But this paragraph here says, in other ways, however, there's almost no effect. Once you're actually in a social network, the slot machine effect continues to work just as well as it always has. Pull to refresh, see if you've got more likes, look at new posts that appear, rinse and repeat. So it's almost game mechanics, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's Angry Birds on a whole different scale.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair shout. At the end of the day, it's about your behavior and the reason that we use our phones. This is the thing, the thing connected to the school issue I was just talking about. People are on their phones because they really enjoy them, you know, and they want to. The stuff that they do on them, they want to do that stuff. And there are many occasions when the stuff they're doing on their phone could just be binned. You know, it doesn't need to be in their life. Like he says here, trawling Twitter or sending garbage Snapchats to friends. And that's an interesting thing about one of the things. It's like making funny comments on friends' posts. Is that a worthwhile activity or not? Do you know what I mean?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, who are we to say that anything is... I mean, as educators, we kind of want to say that there's a balance to be had. But, I mean, certainly I've realized, I guess since becoming a consultant, just how important it is just touching base with people, you know, making sure everyone's okay, like just having an interaction with people on a regular basis just to keep that relationship going. Mm-hmm. And, okay, there's a balance to be had there, but... Yeah.
I think it's quite, so I haven't deactivated my Facebook account, but I've taken it off my phone.
Right.
And I'm just a sort of, I was just conscious of the fact that Facebook is a real spiral drawer in particular. So then I had to go back to using other things more productively, which I quite enjoyed, using Twitter more, using Mastodon. And so when I went to check my phone, that's what I was doing and using those things better. And to be honest, I found that if I refined my usage of Twitter, as in using lists with less people on them and more people who I wanted to hear what they were talking about, then I found it really useful, really quite interesting.
Mm. It's been 10 years since I spoke. It's been 10 years since the launch of the first iPhone. Mm. And so there've been all kinds of iPhone-related articles, even more so than usual. And there's a couple in The Verge. The first one says, the creators of the iPhone are worried we're too addicted to technology. And it basically goes through some of the stuff that we've talked about there, about the capacity for the smartphone having a positive and a negative effect and transitions and how we're still getting used to all this. And it references Gutenberg as ever. But the one which really interests me was the other Verge article, which is entitled "The iPhone Killed My Inner Nerd."
This? I haven't seen this one. No, it's an interesting article.
So this person,
the title for me is kind of clickbait. For me, I'm sure it's not for others.
Well, indeed. So this is somebody who I think is maybe slightly younger than me. And it says, so it talks about being a teenager and what their room was like. When I was a teenager, this time of year would be insufferable. My bedroom would be nearly 90 degrees Fahrenheit without air conditioning, but it wasn't even particularly hot outside. I had at least 5 tower PCs running inside my bedroom, all contributing a lot of heat to my tiny little room. Each performed its own role in my home network, with a file server, domain server, exchange server, and media center PC among them. All of those tower PCs are now inside my pocket, thanks to the iPhone. And he goes on, and he says, you know, all of this, he talks about all the tinkering he used to do, etc. He says, all of that tinkering and hacking things ended for me shortly after the iPhone arrived, and the closest I've come to it recently is playing around with a Raspberry Pi in Kodi. The original iPhone was locked to O2 in the UK and AT&T in the US, but a hack quickly allowed you to run the iPhone on any carrier network. I continued to use Windows mobile devices for a couple of years, but I played with the iPhone on the side as it was always tempting. The interface was smooth, simple, and I didn't have to spend hours loading on ROMs to get a good experience. Once the iPhone 3G arrived, I switched over fully because of the App Store. And the point he's trying to make, Di, is there's a dual-edged sword about these things becoming simpler and more easy to use. I often talk about iOS devices being like Fisher-Price toys, and that they're lovely, and you definitely give them to kids, and they're easy to use and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, like, it's a bit of a dumbing down of...
Yeah, I mean, you find that in schools, don't you? As kids, you know, everyone's assuming the children are coming through more and more digital savvy, but actually the kit that they're using is so easy to use because it's refining its user interface in that direction, is that they don't really understand how to do things on computers, and they're not very technically able whatsoever. But they can get lots of digital stuff done, as in the consumer market kind of thing. So it's an interesting thing, and I'd fully agree with this. Is that I mean, going into using Linux again, I mean, that's got a high sort of level of technical tolerance for the user, and getting it right, unless you buy one that's ready out of the box, which I thought I had, and it wasn't. And I had a really fantastic Skype chat with one of the technicians from the Chinese company, actually, really, really good fun, just sorting out some upgrading the BIOS.
Oh, right, you got that sorted.
Yeah. So that was really, really good. And they were fantastic. It was really helpful and really nice. I mean, communication wasn't a problem, despite the fact they were talking in my language and me not in theirs. But anyway, so on the side of that, I mean, before that, I haven't been inside a computer except as a teacher, like doing it with the children, taking it apart. But I haven't built a computer in 15 years, 12 years, something like that. And just didn't bother doing that anymore because the tech is so much better out of the factory. And the prices have come down and down and down. And so what happens is that my nerdy stuff, as in my geeky, let's put assemble parts of a computer and really understand what they're doing and make them work together, that was just dissipating, you know, over time.
And it depends what we think is important. Like, the things which are going to be important for one generation aren't going to be important for another one. So I had to disassemble my phone to put the new battery in. And so you could see the motherboard, etc. And I showed Bennett, and he was like, oh, great. And he understood, you know, where the different sensors were and what they did and stuff, because he's been taught this in computer science. But there's literally no way that we could solder new stuff onto there or add new functionality or whatever, like you could back in the day with desktop PCs. So it depends what the baseline is. And I suppose the baseline is we do want stuff to work. So I almost think that the fight in the past was on the hardware level. I think the fight now is on the software level and like moving up the stack and making sure that that's open and available for tinkering and not locked down. Like, I think the new version of Windows 10S only allows you to install apps from the Windows Store, doesn't it?
Yes, and that was one of the things I learned about at Microsoft offices. So it's like, I think it's student version. I don't know what the S is really for, but it's like it's like the sheep version of Windows. One of the things
Windows 10 say, sheep version.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what it should be called. Windows 10 sheep. It's like you can't do anything that you want to do. You just have to follow the leader. And But one of the things they did say is that there are no, going to be no more versions of Windows. Windows 10 is it.
Right.
So they're getting away from that thing where they really messed up through, you know, Vista 7, 8, 8 plus.
Until they change their mind.
Well, yes, that's a fair point. So that's that.
Okay. All right. I think you should tell us about the Telegraph Museum in Cornwall that you mentioned at the start of the podcast. And then perhaps if there's anything else which comes out of that, there's a few more links in there. But yeah, otherwise, I think we should probably wrap it up.
I think that sounds right. So a fantastic visit with Amy to Cornwall. And we went to the Telegraph Museum at a recommendation of a friend of mine who's not who's a DT teacher, not a technologist as such. And what an amazing experience. So this museum is in Porthcurno, which is right on the south coast of Cornwall, right down on the tip near the Minnack Theatre, also a fantastic place to visit in the same bay. And it was just an absolutely beautifully put together museum. Really, really interesting. Fantastic use of interactive spaces, costumes that you could dress up in, stuff that you could touch, loads of Morse code and cable code kit that you could use. And just this fantastic principle. The content was fantastic as well. So the idea of taking a cable and plugging it in and then rolling it down the beach and then a couple of thousand miles through the ocean and then plugging it into something and then testing it to see if it works. My gosh, it was just that simple principle that they started investigating. So Telegraph was working on land in by the 1830s. They tried doing it over water. Right. And this took the communication time from 6 weeks to 9 minutes.
Wow.
And you can imagine the impact of that, of sending a message to India, for example. That was the case, 6 weeks down to 9 minutes.
Wow.
And it's kind of connected to the empire, but it's which isn't a great gig, obviously. But it was really interesting in that the life, how huge it was. So cable ships, for example, that are just dedicated to laying cable. And even now today, despite the fact that we're not using Morse code down these wires, we're using fiber optic cable. Only 5% of communications of data is sent over satellite. The rest is all sent on via cables. So Porthcurno still has 14 cables coming in under the sea. From different countries.
Interestingly, when I was in, I think I mentioned this on the podcast, when I was doing that work in Jersey, there's two cables. They get their internet connection from France, mm-hmm. and there's two cables. I think one is redundant or whatever. But anyway, one of them had been severed by a ship's anchor. So.
Well, this is the point. So why is this place in Porthcurno? If you've ever driven down to Cornwall, so the drive for me was nearly 4 hours. Sorry, 343 miles it was to my house, and it took 7 hours, and with you know breaks in it and whatever, and it's really remote. You get down there, the roads are really single file roads, you know, at the time. But why do they choose Porthcurno? Because hundreds and thousands, a period of 100 years, went to and from, because it was a training college for telegraphers, And the reason they chose it is the bay has no rocks in it whatsoever, so ships cannot lay anchor, and that's that.
So the
wires would not be snagged, and that's why it's still used today, because it's just a complete. So they tried it 20 miles down the road at Falmouth, and that was no good because you got these big, which is the third deepest natural harbour in the world in Falmouth, but still there was this.
No good.
So anyway, lots of really, really interesting things. The tunnels that go into the cliffs to protect it when the war came along, because it was key core communication things. How communication cables of Germany, for example, were targeted and broken during the war and things like that. Really, really fascinating.
So there's World War II. I'm just looking on the website now. There's World War II tunnels and all that kind of stuff.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure they must feature these, I'd imagine.
Yeah. So difficult to get to, but I'm guessing it'll be a great place to take students and school trips. It'll
be a fantastic student trip if you're doing that. Fantastic family trip if you're down that way. Really, really worth the bother. So it's a couple of 3 hours to do what they, just to follow the thing. And we watch the. I don't enjoy museums much, to be honest. I'm not much of a historian.
Oh.
This was fascinating.
Cool. Well, we're going to be in Devon in August, so it's always a bit of a hassle getting from Devon to Cornwall in the summer holidays. But yeah, if we do go down there, I'll look it up.
Mm, maybe go around the outside. You take a boat.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
Anyway, yeah, definitely worth the bother.
All right.
Right.
Okay, so it's the 7th of July right now. And this is the bit where we say what we've got coming up over the next week. I'm going to suggest, and we have talked about this earlier, that we now have a break until September, which seems like a ridiculously long amount of time. But I've got some work that I'm doing for Freeformers. I've got an intense period of work coming up with them around writing some curriculum and schemes of work and stuff. Which is going to be really interesting. And then I'm starting some work with a company called Tatara, who create like an LMS based on Moodle. So I'm going to do some work around community stuff there. And obviously, it's the summer holidays as well. So we've struggled to be able to record this over the last 3 weeks with us both being busy and all different things. I'm going to be extremely busy and on a holiday. So if we do find time, then absolutely let's record a podcast. But if we don't, then I suggest that we kind of manage people's expectations and come back in September.
Well, that'd be lovely. That's fine by me, obviously, because I'm on holiday. So what it means is that plans change at the last minute. And like I was sailing, for example, last week. That, what is to say about that in relevance to digital stuff, technology, education? I met some people from a school where they've got Microsoft Surface tablets to every teacher. And they've got the third form, so the year nines, have all got Microsoft Surface tablets, and then it's all BYOD above that, and they're just sort of, you know, rolling it in as using this particular tablet, this particular computer. And so I asked them about it. So I asked teachers who are using it, and I asked pupils who are using it, sixth form pupils, and they said it didn't work in a mixed environment very well. And they didn't like using it. This was the interesting thing. So it was good to use it sometimes, but not to use it at others. And teachers were slow in learning what those times were, which I thought was a really interesting insight.
Oh, interesting.
And paper would just do sometimes. And when it did, just let paper be the thing. And,
Definitely. So what are you doing during the summer holidays, Di? You got any big plans?
No, I have no big plans. So I'm chilling out for a couple of weeks. I'm doing a speech at my parents' golden wedding anniversary tomorrow, as I said earlier. And I've got a trip to Poland planned for 3 nights, like I went with the same people I went to Madrid with last year, which is good fun. That's just before term starts again. And in between, I don't know what I'm doing yet. I might go to France. I might go to America. I might stay around. I kind of want to spend a couple of weeks doing some programming or just get into programming more over the holiday and do that constructively. We will see what happens, but no, holiday time.
Good stuff. Right. Well, I'm sure we'll talk even if we don't record a podcast. So
indeed.
All the best. If you're listening to this, then I hope if you're having a holiday either in the Northern or Southern Hemisphere, I hope you have a wonderful, relaxing break. And we will talk again when we see you. So this has been Tide 86. Thank you very much for listening.
Bye-bye. Watching the tide roll.